This is Brass Tactics, policy and strategy for the people, not the politics.
Oh, delete that bit. Oh, wait, no. I'll stand by that. Why did you start recording in the middle of my screen?
Well, I thought you were watching the countdown. And uh-uh. That you'd time your screen to the countdown, because no, immediately before that, you were like, we've burned enough daylight as it is.
Yeah. But you know me, I actually never pay attention when I'm on a roll.
And on that note, welcome back to Brass Tactics. Where, as usual, I'm Joe McGiffin, and I leave whatever I want to into the post-production of these episodes, because Pete never listens to the courtesy link I sent him before we go live with the publication of it anyways. And with me, of course, is Pete. You know I don't listen to these things, Mitchell. Pete, how are you doing today?
I like to keep it a surprise, Joe. You know me. Live life in the moment.
And what is today's surprise? What
today's surprise, I believe, is
Happy
the book.
Happy Pi Day.
Happy Pi Day. Did you have pizza today?
Cheesecake? Well, we did. And we had pizza without even knowing that it was Pi Day.
Yeah, that's funny, because we did the exact same thing.
So this evening, we were supposed to do our first book review podcast, but I know you haven't read the book, but you should.
What if I did, because I did it for my China class?
What China class?
The one for the class that I teach. We have a section on China after we move on from Russia.
Well, I would be very surprised and eating crow if you did, in fact, read the book.
I did, like a month and a half ago.
Oh, yeah, Pete? Well, then what happens on page 156?
Which chapter is that?
That's what I thought. I don't know. I used the digital version.
That sounds like it's somewhere in. That sounds like somewhere in part two, where they're actively accomplishing things, right?
Yeah, yeah. I have some issues with how he presents his original argument, and then breaks his book down into three parts after presenting two distinct parts. But overall, the book we're talking about.
It actually makes me think. Sorry to contradict, cut you off, but it makes me think that he wrote it in two chunks, kind of like a Clausewitz, and he had the first two like ready to go, and then post the election of Donald Trump, he had to revise and update it and add a third part.
So I could see that. It's really the middle part that just doesn't, the actively accomplishing something that I feel like.
I don't think there's that much of a difference between one and three. You know what I mean?
Yeah. One and two.
And two, exactly.
Yeah. It's just a slow transition. But anyway, we're about to get this. So the book for our five loyal audience members is Rush Doshi's The Long Game. I think it was published 2019, 2020?
Yep.
Might have been 2021. Really? Very recent. And it's a very comprehensive study of Chinese strategy, long-term Chinese strategy. And when we say long-term, Pete, I'm going to define long-term as starting circa 1990s.
Okay.
We're starting at the 1990s.
And so we're going to talk with Deng?
We can start in the 1970s, but we are only moving forward from there in this podcast.
All right. So Jiang Zemin administration onward.
Well, really, Deng Xiaoping.
A little bit of Deng, a little bit of Jiang, my favorite.
Who doesn't like a little bit of Deng?
No, I said Jiang. Jiang's my favorite.
Good for the soil.
Yeah. Okay, farmer. Now, when you say long term, though, you mean something that Americans really struggle with comprehending, let alone implementing, when it comes to strategy, right?
Yeah, I think once upon a time, most people agree that there was a grand strategy. At one point, a lot of times you hear the U.S. had two grand strategies as something that I think is pretty commonly discussed. The first one being the isolationist era and the Monroe Doctrine. As a strategy. Mm-hmm.
And the second being containment.
Which in some was creating a regional hegemony, if you will, or at least a regional space of denial around both continents of America in order to protect U.S. interest in its periphery. And then after World War II, when you roll into the Cold War, deterrence itself, or rather containment, probably is the more suitable umbrella term, containing the spread of communism so that sort of like sort of like controlling a brush fire, trying to shape it so that it would have as little fuel as possible, spread as little as possible. And I think those those two would constitute what we would consider grand strategies from the East perspective. But aside from those, that's grand strategy is not typically something the U.S. exhibits or really plans out long term, because even those strategies, they were put into effect at the same time they were planned. There was not a planning in advance of the execution. That all kind of happened at the same time. And that's not what we see with China.
Well, so here's the other thing though. So we should caveat by saying that none of the stuff in the book is backed by direct incontrovertible evidence from the Chinese side, right? So we don't have access to their archives. They don't do minutes of their meetings. They don't, they don't have recordings of their planning sessions. So what Rishtoshi is doing is he's building out from their actions and their postures.
And their publications.
And their publications, right? Their open ones. What they're probably trying to do.
It's fair, but
behind the scenes. I'm not saying that what he's saying is bad. It's just the fact that there's nothing like, and we really probably won't know until the wall comes down.
China does a great job at trying to control the flow of data in and out of their country, and has done so since Tiananmen Square. They're just very good at it. So yes, what Rishtoshi does is very, very thorough, very rigorous guesswork and infers a grand strategy. But frankly, he makes a very compelling case based off of what little data is available from China in written text, documents, and other transmissions that he was able to source or have been previously sourced by other research endeavors. And in this, he lays out two separate epochs of grand strategy. And in the first phase of this, going up from the 90s until roughly 2009, it was survival. The Chinese goal intended to survive relative to the United States, because everything about Chinese strategy is oriented towards the United States. And around 2009, they start shifting towards a more thriving mindset, towards building their own actual power base and expanding their influence towards a bid for regional and then global leadership.
Right. Because so initially he says that the major threat to the Chinese throughout the 20th century is the Soviet Union. Two continental powers that share a huge land border. They're not friendly with each other. When the Soviet Union falls, as Joe says, the all-consuming strategic aim of the Chinese is to displace, to remove the Americans first from East Asia and then later from their global hegemony. That's the kind of the long march, the long game that they're playing. There's a fixed and a very definite end goal that they're aiming for. That's his hypothesis.
Yeah, and it wasn't just the collapse of the USSR, because like the USSR and China weren't exactly friends, to say the absolute least, but neither of them were particularly fond of the United States. When does the USSR officially dissolve?
91.
Is it 91?
Yeah.
Okay, and when did Tiananmen Square not happen?
89.
So in 89, you have Tiananmen Square, which was a wake-up call to the Chinese as well. That comes in the same era of the USSR's collapse.
Well, because like the Berlin Wall has come down, right? So that what happens in 89. So it's kind of the beginning of the end for the Soviets by 89.
Okay.
The Chinese can see what's happening. There's a wave. Huntington calls it the wave of democratization.
And something that's important to caveat as well here is the United States isn't drawing dots, connecting the dots of these three different data points that all happen on top of each other. First, 89, Tiananmen Square allegedly does or does not happen, in which a bunch of Chinese students may or may not have been slaughtered while peacefully protesting.
Bunch meaning estimates up to 35,000+. We have no clue.
Because China realized that there was a major sociocultural threat posed to the Chinese party, the ruling party and the ruling class by this idea that individuals have free rights and have freedom. This really? This poisonous ideology permeates through their culture. See a protest, they violently suppress the protest as communists are wont to do, regardless of what nation they come from. So and this real makes China realize they have to control their data flow and they have to protect themselves from these dangerous ideologies. So they start building out a buffer in their own country and as much as they can in the peripheries in order to blunt America's cultural influence over this part of the region. And then right after that, bam, bam, boom, this fun thing kicks off in 91, something about Iraq and Kuwait, oil's probably involved. We know it as Desert Storm. America remembers it as proof positive that they are the apex military that will never be defeated and are the most cutting edge, blah, blah, blah. There was a 3-week air campaign followed by a 4-day land invasion where Desert Shield and then Desert Storm successfully fought as the most decisively successful war in recent memory.
Yes.
Possibly ever.
Correct.
And it featured all of these new sophisticated technologies, all lots of this computer and satellite based.
Yep.
And China sees this and goes, oh, crap. The U.S. has a military that is nigh on unstoppable.
Mm-hmm.
Nigh on being a very important term that we'll circle back to later. So they see this cultural threat, and then they see this military threat. And then finally, they see the political threat.
So this is what is, yeah, these three events are what's known as the three, like the three great tragedies to the Chinese. You have one after the other, Tiananmen Square, Desert Storm Shield, and the fall of the Soviet Union. And that shatters their preconceptions of kind of like, oh, well, we had everything under control.
And this notably, is them. Yeah. This is them looking at it. Like, America does not really connect these three in any meaningful way. We think
everything's great. We think it's end of history. Champagne.
I don't think we thought the massacre at Tiananmen Square was great.
Well,
but the other two.
No,
were.
But the wave of liberalization and democratization that
agreed.
Is sparking that is like, oh, wow, the Chinese, we got them on the road. Finally, McDonald's and Lexus is for everybody. Notably, what's Xi Jinping doing at this time? Do you know?
I actually don't.
Yeah, he is a, he's the president
of the
party.
He doesn't come on until like 12 or whatever, right?
Yes, well, so, but he is building power and he's paying attention. So he is, he was formerly the secretary for his father's former boss, Geng Biao. Secretary General of the Central Commission. But then in the 80s and 90s, he's out in Fuzhou province and he's serving as the chair of their political party. So he's in the kind of like the central area. Fuzhou, down south. Fuzhou's down below Shanghai. But he's watching and paying attention to all this stuff very carefully. These are his formative years when he's like a mid-career. He's in his like 30s and 40s at this point.
So he becomes a big deal a little bit later as he is today. But
he's still kind of a nobody.
I wonder if this is the episode that gets the bot farms after us. Maybe we say too many.
We need to say more buzzwords. You've already
said
it.
Right, we say too many keywords. The algorithm triggers something over across in the Indo-Pacific, and then bags end up over our heads.
All attention is no. They're just gonna review bomb us and give us a bunch of 1-star reviews saying we're a bunch of neoconservatives or something.
But you did review us. You drive up that traffic for us. Exactly.
You fell into our trap. The algorithm doesn't care.
But yeah, so this trifecta of tragedies from the Chinese perspective reinforces.
Yep. And the current premier at time is Jiang Zemin, who is seen by us, by the Americans, sorry, when he's put into power as like a reformer.
And China does, they adopt something. What was Deng Xiaoping from the 80s or 70s or both?
He's general secretary from 89 to 2002.
Okay, so he's about to come on. So in this era, they have this phrase that basically translates to hide capabilities and bide time. So they need to be able to become a certain amount of strong or flexible, adaptable in order to be able to eventually contest the U.S. on the global scale. In the meantime, they at least need to keep the U.S. from being able to meddle in Chinese affairs and in Indo-PACOM regional affairs. And so they build these political and economic relationships and ties with all of their neighbors, and they do so quietly. At the same time, they're leveraging the U.S. economy through presenting themselves as humble, reforming, as Pete just pointed out, hat in hand, in order to get access to things like the World Trade Organization and benefit from economic incentives, which is how they grow to be the industrial, the world's factory for everything, as they're still known today, even after the disruptions to everybody's supply chains due to the COVID pandemic.
Appear weak when you are strong, and strong when you are weak.
And it's in this era that they also develop their military strategy, which largely still has a lot of people scratching their heads. This anti-access area denial, or A2AD, in case you've heard this before. And what features around here, and I'm sure Pete's going to throw some nerd lore at me about the actually this missile flies in this particular trajectory. But A2AD largely comprises three components. They have cool mines. They have effective surface vessels like destroyers that are equipped for anti-surface ship warfare and anti-air warfare. And they also, the main thing that was relatively novel, might have been the first ones, I don't really know, it's not that important. They developed shore-based anti-ship missile systems. And these all taken together do a very, very good job of denying enemies getting into certain air spaces and sea spaces, which is why it's referred to as anti-access and area denial capability.
So these are, so none of these are original to the Chinese. They do not invent any of these technologies. However, they adapt them to their purposes, to what something that Rushdoshi calls blunting. The purpose of these things are not to destroy American power in East Asia, but especially not at this point.
And their neighbors aren't threatened by this buildup either, because it's a pretty robust buildup, but it's of specific platforms.
And they are expressly defensive. So a shore-based anti-ship missile is not a offensive weapon, technically. It just depends where you place it.
So the weird thing, just for those listening who are less inclined towards nerd rocketry lore, it's hard to think of a weapon as being purely defensive, because all weapons fundamentally cause damage and you can use them offensively. What we mean in this case by defensive is a missile cannot conquer territory. A missile can only destroy things. So it can destroy an aircraft carrier, for instance, which is carrying planes that can provide the air support for an amphibious assault. And so that missile system is intrinsically defensive because its main purpose is to shoot down that aircraft carrier. What China is not building right now is aircraft carriers. And these aircraft carrier task force groups are the currency of the realm. Countries are going out of their way to buy hollowed out hulks that can't actually function as aircraft carriers at this time, just to say that they have one, because that's how people counted naval power. China deliberately ignored that, invested in submarines, which again, can't really conquer anything, can only shoot other ships up in the sea, and mines. All of these things cannot really be used to wage an offensive war without these other things like carriers, more robust destroyers, and a robust marine amphibious fleet. And that's why we mean that they're defensive.
So the term the Chinese use for these military weapons is Xiaoxiaojian. Xiaoxiaojian, which means the assassin's mace, is the term we translate it to in English. Historically, it was a kind of a mail breaker. It was a heavy iron mace that you could use to shatter an opponent's sword. Now, that mace itself, it could hurt, but it wasn't a perfect offensive weapon. It was meant for defense, to disarm the enemy and remove his ability to try to hit you. The Chinese use this term assassin's mace, Xiaoxiaojian, in the same way when they're talking about their shore-based anti-ship missiles, especially. Because the idea is, again, to blunt, deflect, and prevent a desert storm from ever happening to the Chinese mainland.
And this continues until they buy their first
aircraft carrier.
Partially built aircraft carrier that was a USSR leftover that people forgot about. And they do this.
What's the official story they give, by the way, for when they buy it? Do you remember?
I was going to ask you that, but first I wanted to put this in context, because they buy this at a specific time. They buy this around the same time that, what is his name? Dave Ramsey chastises you and me for not being out there and buying real estate, Pete.
Why are you investing in that funny money?
Yeah. So we done messed up not buying more real estate during the economic recession.
What about this for our Zoomer, audience? They need to know what year that is.
China sees your unbelievably low real estate prices and raises you the cost of one aircraft carrier, which will only be used for tourist purposes.
Yes. They swore up and down, hand on their heart, they were going to turn it into a floating casino hotel in Macau. So they paid the Ukrainians not much, like a few million bucks, and took it. It was in Sebastopol, and they took it under tow, too big for the Suez, all the way around the Horn of Africa, back to China. It was quite an odyssey. And as soon as they brought it in, they didn't take it to Macau. They took it straight to the Guangzhou Shipworks and started hacking it to pieces.
And at this time, Rushdoshi starts talking about China exhibiting traits towards a strategy they call actively accomplishing something. So
phase one, shifting into phase two.
Yeah, phase one was hide capabilities while we buy time. Phase two, don't show your hand, but start making bigger moves. And so you see them reaching out into the economic and political international communities a little bit more here. And what's telling about this is it was 2012 when President Obama announces the pivot to Asia. This kind of, it all lines up, right? So China's switching their strategy, and we can see that. And what they are doing is now being perceived as somewhat threatening. This continues like this until roughly 2016, when the first of the new trifectas start to manifest.
So it's now the pivot to the Pacific, that was also paired with the reset toward Russia, right? Was that the other Obama administration?
It was like a reset.
There was an Obama reset. I forget if that was with either Russia.
Was
or
that
China.
To refocus on peer level threats? It was probably Ukraine. The first Ukraine shenanigans were 2014, 2013.
Yeah, so 2009 and 10. The Obama administration does two. They do both. They try a Russia and a China reset. So they send Hillary Clinton to Russia, and they have him. Oh my gosh, her and Sergey Lavrov. They had a big red button with the word reset, and they pushed it in front of the cameras in 2010. So we all know how well that went. So, and that same thing is happening toward the Pacific. The pivot to the Pacific, I think Rushdoshi also says the U.S. is not trying to provoke the Chinese. They're just trying to turn. They're trying to turn kind of away from Europe and toward Asia because they realize this is where 2/3 of the world population lives. That's where most of our imports come from.
I think there's probably a little bit of putting China on notice there too, though.
Yeah, a bit.
We see what you're doing. We are now watching. Not that it really seems to have that much of a tangible effect. But then 2016 rolls around and the United States starts making some big changes,
don't forget, so in 2013, though, this is also where the Chinese start building those artificial islands in the South China Sea.
You're right.
They're looking at us because we're doing freedom of navigation patrols, and they start building these islands anyway.
The term lawfare starts being thrown around in this era too, because China is manipulating international norms and reinterpreting them in ways that are advantageous to them, such as making ancestral claims on islands that may or may not have existed when sea levels were lower.
Yep, there's a give and take here. And so that actually leads to a pretty hot and simmering anti-Chinese sentiment within the American political electorate, which a certain somebody is able to harness to get elected in 2016. Sorry,
so when President Trump gets elected, and with his famous American First slogan and national strategy, the U.S. starts focusing a little bit more on internal concerns and is less concerned with whatever international leadership roles China certainly sees it has at the time.
Also at the same time, Trump brings in a lot of China hawks, like a lot of them. And like they sharply change their kind of America's open rhetoric towards the Chinese. It becomes a lot less conciliatory. Start talking trade war, start talking tariffs, start getting more aggressive with the presence patrols.
But I I feel like I think that stems from the more polite Obama administration pivot to Asia, honestly.
Yeah, yeah. He was head policy guys who were looking at like, okay, that pivot did not work. They were in the Obama administration. Okay, now we need to change it up. We have to change the playbook.
And I think China will respond accordingly in time, but President Trump's election and then his administration's less concerned view with international affairs definitely is seen as the U.S. pulling out of the international order. This is followed in short order by Brexit from the EU as well. Mm-hmm. And China sees this as a systemic decline of the West. They interpret this, according to Rosh Doshi, as America is now on the downward trajectory that all great nations and empires have faced since time immemorial.
The mandate of heaven.
And then the final trend of this new trifecta was China's gift that kept on giving, which was the poor U.S. response to the COVID pandemic.
But also, what about the U.S. response to the 2014 Ukraine crisis and the color? So you have Russia openly defying the U.S. order.
Yeah, I think there was definitely something to be read in there. Rosh Doshi doesn't really talk about that per se, but I think that had to have gone into the calculus as well. It only makes sense. Yeah. And you see this stark transition. The China sees this as the proverbial shark smelling blood in the water.
Yep.
And it's like a light switch is tripped. China is currently working on 5 different aircraft carriers now. The last one being designed specifically nuclear. So they are now building with conventional navies. They used this Belt and Road Initiative to get their fingers in as many pies as possible, and then they used that as coercive leverage in order to establish bases in these other nations that they can use for force projection. Yeah. And so this was the first I had heard about it, but do you remember the Swedish guy who was in Thailand who was critical of China?
Circa 2019. No, I actually don't really remember him. What was his
name? Well, it was just a vignette he talks about in the book, but I was like, okay, well. And in 2019, he was in Thailand. China kidnaps him. China straight up kidnaps him, brings him back to China, holds him a prisoner for 2 years, makes him sign a confession, recanting all of the criticisms he had about China, and then they imprison him for 10 years. And
Sweet.
The ambassador.
And what's the international community do about it?
So Sweden is famously neutral, or was until they joined NATO. Mm-hmm. Or especially if you don't look at how they were playing both sides in World War II.
That didn't count. Mm-hmm.
But other than that, they're generally considered the most neutralist after Sweden, or Switzerland, excuse me. Mm-hmm. And so the Chinese ambassador in Sweden is giving an interview on national Swedish television, and he's asked about this, and his response was something along the lines of, yes, well, for China's friends, we have open arms and a shared wealth. For China's enemies, we have shotguns. Like, wow, you just said that, like, to the country whose dude you took hostage from a country that wasn't even China. Like,
yes. It's like, actually perfectly encapsulates Chinese diplomacy, though. It's the cannon behind the curtain.
Wolf warrior diplomacy. It is pretty much the most overt, most aggressive stance that China took.
Yep. So Xi gives a speech in 2021. There's this very famous, and Rosh Doshi quotes it, but he says at a party congress, "The world is undergoing profound changes unseen in a century. But time and situation are in our favor." And so that it perfectly encapsulates, like, this is it. The fruit is ripe, and all we need to do is wait, and it will fall into our mouths.
And honestly, my personal assessment of the book, I don't think Rosh Doshi is wrong, but there's been an important development since he wrote that. He even leaves, like, his last chapter is a little bit of a potential, like, way ahead sort of strategy. I think the strategy largely amounts to, okay, the U.S. can play the exact same game China did, but without being totally devoid of freedom and free ideals. You just play the same asymmetric game they did. Because, like, China pretty much runs the U.N. at this point. Almost half of the international organizations that fall under the U.N. now have Chinese leadership at almost every sea level.
Don't forget the WHO during the COVID. It was a scandal.
The Forum on Chinese and African Cooperation, FOCAC, and all of these other mini multilateral commissions.
They have NGOs too. They play the NGO game just like the U.S.
So they are everywhere. But and so Rush Doshi says you could just get the U.S. should just try to get in those. The U.S. should buy into Belt and Road initiatives, so that China no longer can dictate unilateral terms in them, which is kind of low-key genius, I think.
It's pretty based.
That is like the exact, I will see your lawfare, China, and I will play that game better than you. Mm-hmm. One very important development I want to talk about, it's AUKUS. I wanted to talk AUKUS real quick.
Oh, the AUKUS deal, all right.
Because putting AUKUS in this context explains a lot of why China had a considerably large B in their bonnet.
Yep. AUKUS, AUKUS, the Australian, United Kingdom, United States Security Arrangement.
Yes. And so this is the U.S. often ascribes to coalition building and partnerships. I'd say our partnerships generally are superficial, though. There's some really deep abiding ones like South Korea, Japan,
UK,
Europe. There's some long-lasting ones there, but a lot of our other ones just come off as superficial because we throw money at them through the USAID or some other entity like that. Mm-hmm. And there's no follow-up, there's no rapport building. You don't see that with AUKUS. Did we have a formal defensive alliance with Australia before? Because Australia was generally trying to stay out of people's business until China starts pushing their shenanigans over public radios and trying to insert Chinese propaganda into the Australian media.
Yeah, we did. It was called ANZUS, and I remember
that. And then New Zealand pulled out of
and
it.
And New Zealand was like, "Oh, you can't have nukes."
Australia had the same rules too, and I'm about to circle into that. And so China is pushing its coercive ways and trying to bully Australia into get in line with the rest of China's Indo-Pacific agenda. And Australia being Australian, which I feel like there are few people that are more alike than the Florida, Georgia, Bama combination and Australia.
Yeah, it's Australians. I mean, they're both descendants of escaped convicts. Right?
They all have too many poisonous, dangerous things in their environment. And they're not afraid to get hands dirty, right?
You shouldn't say that kind of thing about Atlanta, man.
Well, I was honestly thinking of where I've been, which was the Florida Georgia line and the Georgia Bama line.
Oh, I see. You got plenty of haters down there.
Yeah, dude, you have. There was Charles lived in like this rainwater ditch in front of my apartment. My pet gator.
Oh,
that's just where he lived. He just vibed right there.
I mean, there's a reason why the Seminoles were able to flee into that area, and we couldn't rouse them out.
It's at all. Anyway. Oh man, yeah. It's great down there. I loved it. A little humid though, but
you're welcome
So what they see, and so this relationship, it's so their push on Australia, and they basically try to like freeze Australia out as much as they can politically and economically, and then what comes along, but hey. France, yeah, those are cute little diesel submarine toys. But Australia, we're looking for something stronger right now. The Chinese are kind of like
something with actual range to it, unlike your French diesel subs that can look about 1,000 miles
and
on a
stealth
tank
capability and other things that you know would actually make China back the heck off a little bit.
And cross compatibility with American standard missiles and torps.
And it works. So they go from legally, they can't have a nuclear industry. They ruled against it many moons ago. And so this brings in nuclear submarine capability. It brings in some limited basing capability because you need to be able to maintain these nuclear subs somewhere. And recently, I just saw in the news that like we've moved into other tech domains with AUKUS as well, and they're looking at some space-based applications and innovations as well. And so this is the biggest strategic proverbial hand gesture that the U.S. could have ever accomplished, really.
Oh, it's phenomenal.
Absolutely. Because Japan's hands are tied. Japan's hands are very tight. Well, that was just a byproduct. We don't go out of our way to upset the French, but the French go out of their way to take offense at things.
Yes. But
Japan's hands are tied. South Korea's hands are tied. Article 9, but also just because China knows how close we are with those two nations. Mm-hmm. And so they're very high on the watch list. There's very little they can do that would not be perceived as an offensive threat from China.
That's true. They're very close.
Australia, that was exactly. And so this was a significant strategic victory that I don't think really gets talked about as such. Everybody keeps talking about the nukes, but the why that this AUKUS thing was such a big deal, like unpacking this relative to China, we literally just parked new nuclear submarines in China's back door in a part of the world that they thought they had so completely locked out that they had dramatically switched to this aggressive, offensive, political, economic, and even military pressures internationally just for us to literally help Australia open up a counteroffensive in their backyard.
Mm-hmm.
It's just like, cannot understate how important that strategic alliance was.
It keeps the U.S. with a firm foot in the Pacific as well. So like all right, China, Guam, maybe you could take that out. But Australia, right? So that southern hemisphere part of the Western Pacific, firmly within the U.S.'s grip.
And on top of that, didn't Japan just throw that Article 9 thing out the window?
Oh, no. That's still very much in progress and very controversial. Yeah,
but,
So they're working on
it. Oh, but it is controversial.
Yes, it's split about 60-40, roughly. 60% don't want to change the amendment yet. They want Japan to be stronger, but they don't want to amend it because that will be. They're working.
60% is pretty. Is 60% against is pretty low. Can just give context on what Article 9 means for our few listeners.
So the American. Drafted constitution for the Japanese that they still use. It has an Article 9 in it with two sections.
I think we prefer the term facilitated, the American facilitated constitutional draft of Japan.
We guided their pen. Yes. So Section 1 says that China, Japan, excuse me. Section 1 says that Japan forswears war as a tool of policy. So it's kind of an anti-Clausewitz statement, if you like that, Jim. Section 2 is that Japan will not maintain a military at all. So basically, in accordance with Section 1 of Article 9, we will not maintain a military. They use a specific like kanji character for that too. And so, in accordance with that, Japan does not have an army, a navy, or an air force. They have a ground self defense force, maritime self defense force, air self defense force, which are prohibited from expeditionary activity, except. Which they just recently pushed through 2022, they can do humanitarian assistance, they can do security peacekeeping operations, for example, in the Golan Heights or in Iraq, and they can help an ally if an ally is attacked with military supplies. So, like I said, Japan is supplying a lot of stuff to Ukraine right now, by the way, as well, during the war in Donbas.
Yeah, I'm saying I thought that was an important one because I wasn't really familiar with Article 9 until I had to go research it as well. So China's gone from trying to blunt American capabilities to influence anything in their part of the world to building up a power base to challenge American or perceived American leadership of the world. And I keep emphasizing that perceived because, I don't think I've edited out all of my distaste for the ism that is realism. But one of the stipulations is that the world order is intrinsically anarchic. So at the end of the day, say states are sovereign and no one can tell them what to do. And so if you truly believe that, and you truly believe that the U.S. believes that, then the U.S. can be an leader in terms of influence, but it is not a leader in terms of the full meaning of the word, which seems to be what China is trying to do by literally reshaping the international order in an image that is very suitable for them and their values. And they're doing this very successfully so far, especially through non-state actors and super state organizations like the United Nations. This was probably my second favorite episode because our Putin interview one I thought was really good. And
Putin
think
was
this,
great.
This one, yeah. I think this one was great too.
Yeah. I want to say also, like, just at the end, so the dangerous game that the Chinese are playing is that they don't want to awaken the giant that is the U.S. Like that apocryphal quote to attributed to Isuru Yamamoto during the Pearl Harbor attack is,
"That's
I fear
apocryphal?
Woken."
That's a bummer.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's okay though. It's a good
I
quote.
Don't care.
That's why we still,
like it.
I fear that we have awoken a sleeping giant and filled him with a terrible result. The Chinese don't want that. They don't want the U.S. to feel threatened enough to rev up fully, get on war footing, and rally all attentions, all tools of national power against the Chinese. They want to be assertive, but also enough to kind of lull us and keep it so that they can maneuver us into a position where they have the upper hand, all in accordance with Sun Tzu, right? You want to achieve Xi. You want to get the unstoppable power, the water rushing downhill, the hammer smashing the eggshells, the falcon striking the pigeon. But in order to do this, they've got to exploit differences within the U.S. order. They need to, exploit political parties. They need to, China's not a threat. It's not a threat. It's no problem. Just relax. Go back to sleep, and everything will be fine. And one day we will wake up, and the Chinese will no longer need to do that, because when they are in the dominant position, as the Chinese ambassador said, for our friends, we have open arms and shared wealth. And to our enemies, well, a cannon.
The minute they threaten the U.S. existentially, the U.S. is going to drop everything it's doing and deal with it, because
right.
that is the one thing Americans can agree on, it seems.
For now, at least.
Nobody else is allowed to say horrible stuff about us or do horrible things to us, unless it's us.
Yep. But yeah, dude, great episode, man. I did do my reading, bro. I prepared it well.
Yeah, that was surprising. Mm-hmm. That was probably the most surprising thing I've learned doing this podcast.
I literally just talked this.
Also, please do follow us.
Please. Don't forget to like
us.
We
need followers. Or send money. Pete will sing a song.
I'll sing
work your name
a
into
song
it.
For you, just like John Cena in Chinese. What a show, no, no, bing, chilling. What a show, Fast and Furious 3. All right, bro. Thanks for playing. Let's do this again soon.